Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello and welcome to the Manchester Is Red podcast. My name is Stephen Railston. I'm back to host this episode. I'd like to say recovering from a life-threatening illness. I'm getting there or thereabouts. And I'm joined by my colleague Samuel Luckhurst for this episode. Samuel, I hope you're feeling a little bit better than me today.
Yeah, fortunately I am. Sorry to hear that you're not feeling too well.
I'm feeling a little bit better, but I've still not got my taste back, which is very strange as I'm eating things. There's no incentive really to eat good or bad, I suppose. Should just be chewing on carrots across the weekend. That should have been my plan. There was football on Saturday afternoon. Manchester United drew 1-1 with Burnley. Looked to have won the game with around 10 minutes to go when Anthony scored. A really well-taken goal, actually. Quite impressive. His balance was really good. Celebrated and Old Trafford erupted, and yet Burnley scored 5 minutes later, and the points were shared in the end. We've seen that so often, haven't we, Samuel, this season?
We certainly have. A friend who sits by the tunnel at Old Trafford said that it was like watching United versus United, and it was quite a good succinct summary, and that both teams were bad in different but similar ways. They had good opportunities, but they weren't clinical. They had opportunities right at the death as well, both sides, and didn't take them. The fact that at the end of the game, one of the Burnley analysts sat to our right, just smacked the table. He didn't bang it, but he just smacked it like that, almost sorrowfully, at the game ending in a draw, tells its own story. Burnley completed more passes than United. They had more possession than United. And sometimes those statistics can be completely irrelevant. But the fact that they did create good opportunities, and there were so many other opportunities in terms of them taking the ball forward, but then failing to play an easy pass, which would have put them through one-on-one or would have at least given them the opportunity to have a shot at Andre Onana. It tells its own story. And I mean, I have to fess up, I had the kiss of death, or the commentator's curse, whatever you want to call it, when I was filing my ratings before handing them over for publication. I ended Onana's section as match-winning performance. And then, of course, he pole-axed Amdouni. And unlike against Wolves in the opening game of the season for United, he didn't get away with it this time. And it was a nailed-on penalty. It was pretty strange that the referee didn't spot it at the time. I think it was a fair result as well. Burnley asserted themselves really well. Burnley were pretty bullish going into the game. One of their analysts had been quite candid beforehand, saying that they would target Casemiro, they would play out from the back. They extracted encouragement from Sheffield United scoring twice at Old Trafford a few days earlier, and also from beating United twice this season in behind closed doors games, which I don't think many people would have been thinking about going into the game, but it was apparently part of Vincent Kompany's team talk before they got to Old Trafford. And the days when United had an air of superiority about them at Old Trafford seem quite distant now. They had such a great record at home last season. That's really not been the case this season. Teams are not scared of them. Teams are happy to go toe-to-toe with them. Sheffield United did to an extent. And I suppose the only surprise from a Burnley perspective is that they didn't score as many goals as Sheffield United. They only, of course, got the one goal at the weekend. And for United, it's two wins in nine in the Premier League, which at this stage of the season, wherever you are in the league, whether you're trying to win the title, whether you're trying to finish in the top four, or qualify for Europe, or stay up, or come mid-table, that is a really dismal run. And going back to pre-Wembley in the press room, I remember Rich, formerly of this parish, he said before the game, he said there was no way United will win these next three games against a championship side. And the two excuse me, the two worst teams in the Premier League. And in the end, they only won one of them, excluding penalty shootouts. And again, that really tells its own story.
They started quite well, actually, and seem to do. And have done quite regularly this season, where start of intensity look quite good. But if they don't score, that's the problem. Then they start to lose confidence, and that's exactly what happened. Burnley began to wrestle back control, ended the first half very strongly, and kind of when it was half time, Burnley could have been ahead. I think at that point, Garnacho was wasteful, I thought, in that first half. He has been in the last few weeks. I think his finishing needs to improve, actually. Still only 19, I must add. The result officially confirms there'll be no Champions League football next season, Samuel. I mean, we've known it for a long time now. It's been fanciful, a bit of a pipe dream, because of the way they've been playing and performing. But Aston Villa's draw with Chelsea, of course, at Villa Park confirmed that. But just another nail in the coffin, perhaps, for Ten Hag.
Well, history would suggest that's the case as well. Whenever they've failed to qualify for the Champions League post-Ferguson, there's been a change of manager, either at the end of the season or during the season. And beyond that, we've spoken about it, chapter and verse, the inability to control games, the amount of defeats in the Premier League, going out of Europe altogether before Christmas, the manner in which their League Cup defence ended with that home humbling by Newcastle back in November, and the current run of form they're in as well at the moment. As I said, two wins in nine in the Premier League is... It's really, really, really poor. And the Fulham defeat killed killed them. And we had a sense it would going into it, of course. The day before it was announced that Hoyland would be injured for 3 weeks. And at that time, he was the one injury they absolutely could not afford. Football is not, it's not a complicated game. When United have had an in-form striker scoring every week in every game this season, they've had their best run of form. And when Hoyland came out of the team, that's when the wheels fell off, because of course they did have momentum in February. They weren't always convincing with some of those wins, but they were winning. And from February onwards, it's all about the result takes precedence over the performance. Of course it does. But just looking at it now, since that Fulham game, they've had four wins. And that's in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 games, four wins in 12. Forest in the Cup, Liverpool in the Cup, Everton at home in the league, and Sheffield United at home in the league. That's unacceptable. No two ways about it. And the galling reality that United privately acknowledge now is that they are bracketed with Villa, Tottenham and Newcastle. And there's a chance that all three of those teams could finish above them this season. Villa will probably host European Cup football for the first time in 41 years. Since they won the European Cup in 1982, the only trophy they've won has been the League Cup in 1996, when it was called the Coca-Cola Cup. Tottenham have won two League Cups in the last 30 years, when it was sponsored by Worthington in the 90s and then Carling in the 2000s. And unfortunately for Newcastle, they've not had a major trophy since 1969. So this is the company United now keep. They are not among the elite in the Premier League. And last season, they finished above Liverpool. Now, points-wise, they're closer to Everton rather than Liverpool. And Everton only just, at the weekend, their victory against Brentford confirmed their survival. However people try and spin it, there's no getting away from it. This has been a really, really negative, poor season from United, particularly given how good last season was. I don't think any of us really expected them their form to nosedive like it has done.
I don't think it helps for the fans who have come home from Old Trafford after a Saturday afternoon, might have went out for a drink in Deansgate, and then they've came in, put match day on at 10:30, and the first thing that comes up after the highlights is Ten Hag in his interview, and he says, "I think we're one of the most dynamic and entertaining teams in the league." Really bizarre, the most dynamic comment, I think, Samuel. I mean, they are entertaining.
They are, yeah.
Plenty of goals, unfortunately, guaranteed. They might raise heart pulses, I think, and it's like a basketball contest quite often when you watch United. But in terms of describing United as one of the most dynamic teams in the league. I mean, you only really see that at Old Trafford if Manchester City, Arsenal or Liverpool are visiting, don't you? I mean, they've scored 52 goals this season. That's the same as Bournemouth, Brighton and Brentford. And they've definitely got more in common with kind of that mid-table fodder than the zero title challengers, don't they?
You're right, Stephen. I mean, you're so right that if you went to a press conference this week, you might not be able to ask a question with a view like that. But this is the reality, and we're reflecting reality. And unfortunately for Ten Hag, a lot of what he has said in the last 4 or 5 months, you just think, why have you said that? Or what are you talking about? I mean, in terms of the entertaining aspect, he is right for the wrong reasons, in that there have been, I think, with the goal at the weekend, there have been, I think, 33 goals in the 80th minute and onwards in United's 90-minute games, and 18 have gone to the opposition, which is a huge, huge problem. I mean, this has been a season where United have had 4 pulsating added time winners, climaxing, of course, with Amad's in the 121st minute against Liverpool. And I think Bayer Leverkusen have had a tendency to score late goals this season en route to winning their first Bundesliga title. But with United, they're nowhere near top spot or challenging for the title. They've not challenged for the title since they last won the title in 2013. And I thought what was telling about when that clip was posted by the Match of the Day Twitter account, it had about 100, I think it said 110 quote tweets and something like 1,000 plus. I think it was about 110 retweets and then something like 1,000 plus quote tweets. And you know, when that happens, that's pretty much people wanting to ridicule it or revel in it or question it or try and draw more attention to the sheer, just the bizarre nature of the comment. And this is a manager whose maxim last season was good is not good enough, who was constructively critical quite often when United won games. And we sometimes raise our eyebrows at some of the things he was saying, but you'd think this is refreshing. This is what they need. They've got a manager who is striving to raise the standards, who won't accept United just being good. And you think they've absolutely got the right man in charge there. Since he was effectively placed on trial by Ineos, his rhetoric in press conferences, pre-match or post-match, quite often it's the tone of a man who is endeavouring to keep his job. And he's in an invidious position, and I have some sympathy in that. It's an occupational hazard that you have to front up after a game, and sometimes you've got God knows how many broadcasters there to speak to before you get along to the press conference for a grilling, particularly if it's, of course, a bad result. But we've seen this before with Manchester United manager. When they start talking like someone who doesn't sound like a Manchester United manager, they're on very thin ice. And it was just a strange comment to make after a game when Burnley had really good chances to win it, had more of the ball than United at Old Trafford, outpassed United as well. And the biggest statistic was on the scoreboard. It ended 1-1. It was United 1, Burnley 1. Burnley are 19th in the Premier League table. That's another big concern. And look, United, as you said early on, in the first 20 minutes, I thought they were very good. They were creative. It actually felt like the goal was a matter of time. But when that goal didn't come, Burnley had a shot inside the first 20 seconds. But Burnley were emboldened and they started to come out of their shell a little bit more. And they knew United were gettable because there's ample evidence of that this season. The back four doesn't get ample protection and they concede a lot of shots. And they did again at the weekend against a team that, you know, backed themselves as quite good, quite good technicians of creating opportunities. And also Burnley haven't lost many games recently. I think they've only lost one of their last eight now, which is pretty good going. Probably not enough for them to keep to stay up, but they're not as tough enough to crack as they were maybe earlier in the season. But still, to quote Gary Neville, this is Manchester United we're talking about, and they should be doing a hell of a lot better against a team. When you look at Burnley's lineup, it's a championship team in everything but name. They're bound for the championship, but United still failed to beat them, having just about scraped a win against them at Turf Moor back in September. And that's another thing that should possibly concern Ten Hag. If you were to compare those two games and the time between them, which is what, 7 months, have United improved from ending a bad run of form in September to get a pretty gritty win at Turf Moor? Have they improved? No. I mean, do you think they've improved?
I'm not nodding an improval there. I'm just nodding. Sorry, I am nodding an improval with your comments. I'm not nodding to say they've improved.
No, sorry, improved. Sorry, yeah, improved.
Yeah. He keeps on saying that, oh, look, we'll learn from this, we'll improve from this. And he's been in charge for almost 2 years now, and this season's just been a constant regression, hasn't it? Unfortunately, after these performances and these results, and he comes out and says things like that, and you don't say it a month later, a week later, unfortunately. It has just been regression. And having said all that, Samuel, still should have won. I mean, if you're a United fan, you're banging your head against the wall when they conceded that penalty, because if you score with 10 minutes to go, you should be able to see out that game. Christian Eriksen came out and spoke to MUTV after just a very brief interview, as you'd expect. And you could tell he was just so disappointed, and his criticism was kind of subtle in the sense that he said, look, we've got to win that game. And it's the truth. I mean, Andre Onana, a clumsy foul. Casemiro didn't obviously play his part.
It was a bad header, yeah.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. But still, Onana has form for that, doesn't he? As you mentioned, his mistake against Wolves on the opening day of the season, he was very lucky to get away with that. Very lucky. And it's like lightning didn't strike twice, unfortunately. Obviously clattered him, kind of. That's the problem with Onana, Samuel. I think those 90 minutes kind of encapsulated him perfectly this season, because although he can produce wonderful saves, as he did in the first half, and it was a fantastic save, that was a reaction save with his left hand and to save that header, he can throw in a massive error like that as well.
He can, and I mean, in United's, some people's United attempt to portray this period as not actually that bad, and how they've got 2.4 goals this calendar year, and only City apparently have lost more games than them this calendar year. They cited Onana's form, and that was before the game on Saturday. And I thought, well, he was at fault for Sheffield United's first goal in the week, and there've been a few savable shots he's let in recently. There was one at, pretty sure there's one at Bournemouth, wasn't there? I think it was Justin Kluivert's. He got beaten far too easily at his near post. And of course, he gave away the penalty at the weekend. I think February, March time, he was playing better. But if it was Ten Hag of last season, he'd be saying good is not good enough. And unfortunately for Nana, twice last week, he committed errors that led to goals. As I said, he was in match-winning mode until that foul on Amdouni at the weekend. His save from Foster, the header in the first half, was one of the best saves of the season, given how close Foster was to him, the ricochet. Not only did he keep it out, he got the ball away from harm's way as well. He made another good stop from Foster in a one-on-one, even though the finish was a little bit meek. But it was good goalkeeping, undeniably good goalkeeping. And unfortunately, it was ruined by the error at the death. But again, the problems are way beyond Onana. I mean, if you're looking at what United need to do to reconstruct the team, reconstruct the squad next season, as flawed as his campaign has been, you're not looking at the goalkeeper and thinking they need to change there immediately. He is far too exposed. That back four is far too exposed. And there's clear mitigation for that with the injuries. But I think it was Neville who said it recently, and we've said it as well. They've had matches recently where, yes, they've had a lot of significant injuries, but they've also been only two or three players shy from fielding their best 11, pretty much. And at the weekend, I thought it was a mistake to name an unchanged team. Eriksen was really poor against Sheffield United. Anthony was fortunate to start, but he took his goal really well, as you said. So there was some vindication there for Ten Hag. But the midfield was not particularly robust. They got overrun. Obviously, the Mainoo substitution was deeply unpopular with the crowd. I think the crowd probably thought, well, if you're taking a midfielder off for Scott McTominay, that's fine, but it's got to be Christian Eriksen because he looks fatigued and he's just, you know, been played through. He could barely run, and his pass intended for Garnacho was very easily cut out. That must have happened about 5 minutes before Mainoo was taken off. And so Ten Hag has the options to protect the back four more. He could play Sofyan Amrabat if he wants to, having touted him as back in September as we needed another six and we've got one. They've got one. He started once in the I think he started once for United since the draw at Anfield on December the 17th. He's faded so far into the background. There's no, he might as well be in the stands, never mind on the substitutes bench. And we said this a few weeks ago, didn't we? We said there is probably a solution there to ensure that they're more compact, that they manage games better, that the defence is better protected. And I think a better coach would have found a solution by now. Ten Hag hasn't. Things are not improving. Things, if anything, are worsening in terms of how exposed and onerous, how exposed the back four are. And he might not get the chance to redress it next season. And again, you look at United, yes, very creative at the weekend, had plenty of chances, plenty of shots as well, but they're so exposed. It's almost like they've got two teams within a team. You've got the front six, and then you've got the other five who are left to fend for themselves. When the opponents have the ball,
don't you? You need some compromise from the attacking unit to come back, and you might score fewer goals, but you'll concede fewer. So, and you can't win games when you're conceding at the rate United are, and giving up such a large rate of opportunities. Andre Onana, as we said, is far too exposed every game. He's been called into action far too often. It just can't happen next season. Whether Ten Hag is here to oversee that remains to be seen. That'll be it for part one, and we'll be back in a moment for part two. We'll start off this part talking about Rasmus Højlund then, Samuel. It's probably worth discussing a bit further in his season so far. Obviously just recently returned from injury and scored his first goal after that problem against Sheffield United last weekend. His performance was not great again on Saturday afternoon. His hold-up play isn't the best. He's not really getting into games. He's struggling at the moment. I think if he was holding up the ball and offering a bit more, people could be a bit more sympathetic. But also on the flip side of that, and this is why, I mean, I've said this a few times on the podcast as we've discussed him, but he's not getting the service. He's just not getting the passes into him at all. We'll talk about this kind of a attacking unit, but he's really not getting anything into him, into his feet or crosses, I don't think, at the moment. I think earlier in the season, in the autumn time, he was missing chances, so that excuse didn't wash. But what have you thought about Højlund, Samuel? I mean, he scored 14 goals in all competitions, 8 in the Premier League, 5 in the Champions League, and 1 in the FA Cup. If that was offered at the start of the season, fans have taken that with Højlund. I know he was saying for 72 million, but he's still quite young and raw.
I think it would have been a surprise had he got 20 goals just because of how callow and unproven he was. And you come into that environment at United with the scrutiny and the pressure to spearhead the attack in a team that finished third last season, where automatically the expectation is, okay, got to climb up the ladder. If you're going to climb up to second, you might as well challenge for the title. That has to be the mindset. And United now give the impression that wasn't the mindset, which is a big problem, because that's unacceptable for a club of United stature. And they spent a hell of a lot of money on Højlund, having said that they wouldn't spend more than £60 million on him. They went over that with the upfront fee. And regarding this current run or rut that he's in, I don't have a great deal of sympathy for him because at the weekend, United created plenty of chances. In that first half, Fernandes hit the post. Anthony had a couple of opportunities. Maynou had a shot go wide. Eriksen had a shot just go narrowly wide. Garnacho skied one on the half volley. So that's five of the front six who had good opportunities. The one who didn't get a chance is the striker. Now, that's not just because they won't give him the ball. That's because he doesn't make the right runs or he's got a lack of confidence. There's no doubt he's struggling for confidence at the moment. I know he got the goal against Sheffield United last week, but this period since he came back from injury, it's been his worst period this season, because at least during the games in September, October, and to a lesser extent, November, you could see the potential. He got goals in the Champions League. His performance against Galatasaray at home, particularly his second goal, that was a very singular finish. And there was plenty to get behind. And okay, you thought you've got to give him a bit of time, but when you're in the Man United maelstrom and you're a striker, you will be judged on how many goals you score. And in fairness to him, he's got as many goals now as Dimitar Berbatov got in 2008-09. Berbatov was a club record signing, and he'd spent 2 years in the Premier League doing very, very well in a pretty decent Tottenham team who actually did win something as well. So that's how tricky it is to go into the Man United dressing room as a striker. The pressure takes its toll on even a Premier League proven quality player, firmly established player who was in his late 20s at the time, as Berbatov was. Never mind someone who joined the club as a pretty raw 20-year-old in the summer, as Hoyland was. And as we've said plenty of times, the planning was just not good enough in the summer, because they thought, we'll bring him in and Anthony Martial is the backup striker, without really giving enough serious consideration to the fact that, one, Martial's goal scoring record in recent years has been dreadful. Even worse has been his injury record. He played in 28 games out of 62 last season. You cannot rely on him. He's already nearly 4 weeks behind on his scheduled comeback from groin surgery. And also during pre-season, when people at United were discussing what they would do with Hoyland, they said there'll be some games where he starts up front, there'll be some games where he won't start up front, and Rashford can play. It was Rashford who was named. It wasn't Martial. And Rashford, as we know, is not a striker. And this season, he's gone to pot. Just full stop. Wherever you play him, United have struggled to get a tune out of him. So it was a mistake. I maintain it was a mistake to sign an unproven striker in the summer. It was a mistake to think that Anthony Martial could be relied upon this season. The only slack you can cut United's way is that I don't think anybody really foresaw Rashford's form falling off a cliff like it has done. He can blow hot and cold, and I think that's been borne out this season. He's been very, very inconsistent in the last 3 or 4 years in terms of his performance level over the course of a season. But having scored 30 goals last season, there'd have been very few people who'd have predicted he would have 8 goals going into May this season, and that he'd be disciplined twice by his manager, and social media posts would be coming from his account at 12:30. Yeah, it's been an eventful season for him for all the wrong reasons. And I've said so many times that Hoyland has been overexposed. And look, when it was working great in February, he was in a really good run. He does keep going. He tries his heart out. He got a goal against Sheffield United last week he kept on going, and it was a really good run he made as well. It was brilliant from Fernandes, who he had a little look, and then he played the ball in exactly the right area, and Hoyland was very quick to point to him. But Hoyland, we're not seeing him make enough of those runs, I don't think, and too often at the weekend he was dropping too deep.
Samuel, I think he does. There's sometimes when I've spotted runs, really, and not all the time. I think it is fair to be critical of quite a bit of it, but there is times when I don't think he gets the service, and I think that's a huge
earlier.
I think there was a stat after that game of the weekend where Andre Onana had actually passed the ball to him most of any outfield player. That's just incredible.
That is absolutely a problem. And I agree with you. There have been times this season where we've seen a player, usually Rashford, go down the left and he's not played the ball at the right time. And Hoyland and him have bickered a few times as well over Hoyland not getting the ball. And unfortunately, the tone was probably set on Hoyland's first start for United against Brighton when Rashford needlessly overplayed it, took the ball out, and Hoyland scored, VAR checked it, and the goal was chalked off. And then Hoyland had to wait another 3 months to get his first Premier League goal. I say wait. He had plenty of opportunities to score before then. But thinking about it now, that was crucial, that moment, for both players, in that it was almost as if they got off on the wrong foot, because there was definitely some bickering going on between them that day, I recall. And United got thumped 3-1 by Brighton. And at the time, it felt like Brighton are the bee's knees. And it turns out that Brighton's season peaked probably with that performance and that victory against United all the way back in September. But the weekend, I thought Hoyland was dropping deep too often. And when a striker drops deep, more often than not, it's because it's born out of frustration. They don't feel as though they're getting the ball enough, so they want to get on the ball more. And then they're trying too hard, and then they're further away from goal, and thus they're not going to be a threat to the opponent's goal. And I thought it was telling as well that when it came to the double substitution and Hoyland's number went up, I wondered, are they going to turn here? Because they did when he was brought off against Brighton, and they did when he was brought off against City. There were loud boos when Hoyland was removed in those two games. At the weekend, when he came off for Ahmad, there was an acceptance from the crowd. It was an acceptance of he's not done it today, and we need someone new up front. Ahmad's popular, of course, after his goal against Liverpool. And when he comes on, he tends to do quite well for United. And then, of course, the irony is that there were boos, and it was Firmino going off, not Hoyland going off. So it didn't feel like it was one of those games where I actually understood it's not great when you're taking a striker off at 0-0 and you're putting someone on who's not a striker. And Ten Hag he used Ahmad there in his first pre-season. I think when he brought him on against Rayo Vallecano at half-time, and he scored quite quickly after coming on. But nobody really looks at Ahmad and thinks he can double as a striker. We'd like to see him on the right wing, but that hasn't happened from the start, full stop, under Ten Hag. But certainly at the weekend, although it's not a light-for-light replacement, there was an understanding that United need something a bit different up front, because Hoyland wasn't getting anywhere.
His run comes to mind at Wembley against Coventry for McTominay's goal, when I know he didn't get there, but his run was really dangerous and kind of created that moment of hesitation where McTominay probably capitalised from that and found the back of the net. So I thought that was a good run, although in ideal circumstances, you'd like Hoyland to actually put it in the back of the net himself, I suppose. Oh, we're getting to the stage now where we need another striker to come in, which we already know that, but someone who can start every week over Hoyland. Because the whole kind of approach has been Hoyland needs an understudy or someone more experienced there, perhaps not to start every game, but to learn from and to support him in matches. But we're getting to the point now where next season United need a striker who can start every game, and Hoyland will be that. Sorry, Sammy, my voice is going now. If this
no problem.
And Hoyland can be that player coming on from the bench.
Or just someone to keep Hoyland on his toes. They tried it with Cavani when he came in, and rather than keeping Anthony Martial on his toes, he trampled all over them, because Martial, as we know, when competition comes in, falls to pieces, doesn't like it. And I think Hoyland is made of sterner stuff and has a better mentality. And of course, they absolutely need a striker in the summer. There's no two ways about it. And if Manchester United are signing a quality striker in the summer transfer window as well, which is an important distinction given that Ighalo and Weghorst came in winter transfer windows, then it is going to cost a fair bit of money. Whatever the role of that striker, they could be quite creative and maybe go for an unlikely name, someone who's playing backup at another club possibly. but they need to sharpen the tip of their arrow, because although there is potential in Hoyland, when you're leading the line for Man United, there's so much pressure on your shoulders, and it's quite onerous. And that's why I have some sympathy for him this season, because he's not had any support. And I've mentioned that to Ten Hag in press conferences. Like, is he disappointed with Marshall for not getting back quickly enough, not doing more when he's had opportunities to ease the burden on Hoyland? There could have been a mentor-mentee relationship going on there if United had a different striker. I think we all knew that was never going to be the case with Marshall as the alternative number nine. And let's face it, Hoyland's first start for United, when he was hooked for Anthony Marshall, that probably amplified the boos. I mean, I remember after at the post-match press conference, it was Neil Custis who said to Ten Hag, he said he thought that the booing was probably worsened by the identity of the replacement for Hoyland, because let's face it, most United fans wish Marshall went years ago, and it's been years since he was an asset for them as well. But looking ahead to this summer, I don't think you can worry about upsetting Hoyland. He's very fortunate to be at Manchester United at the age that he is, given that he had pretty modest goal-scoring records in Denmark, Austria and Italy. And United are not going to be in the Champions League next season, so they need quite a few dependable goal scorers, whether they're strikers or forwards, multifunctional forwards, whatever. There are a lot of forwards in the United squad who cannot be there next season or should not be there next season. So you can't pussyfoot around it. You can't fret about, oh, Rasmus might take exception to that. You've got to have a competitive environment there. And I don't think Hoyland would be unduly concerned about that. And if anything, it could improve him if he has got that competition and he has got someone keeping him on his toes. Who that player will be, is anyone's guess. It will be interesting to see what United do regarding that particular position in the summer transfer window. But they absolutely need someone.
The centre forward, sorry, Samuel, isn't it? Because we all sit on podcasts, journalists, fans, media, everyone, and say what they could do with a striker. But unfortunately, we're just so scarce at the moment. When you actually look out there in Europe and look at the options available, there's very few top strikers who you think could go sign, or and they'd cost too much, or there's maybe a lack of strikers who could play that kind of backup role. So can we find an extra Garlo is the question, Samuel. To play devil's advocate, and I'll probably contradict some of what I've just said. I mean, 14 goals, I think, is actually an all right season, is it not? If you looked at Hoyland coming in at the start,
it's okay.
He's 21 years old. With 25 goals, I think that would have been excellent. 20 would have been great. And 14, let's say he scores one or two more. It's an all right season, isn't it?
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I don't think come the end of the season we'll be looking on it and thinking or saying he had a bad season. He was dreadful. None of us have said that. There's been plenty of context written around why he has scored. He's at par, really, isn't he, in terms of his goals? Looking at his record at previous clubs, you'd have thought between 10 and 15 goals for Man United this season, yeah, that would probably do it. That would be a fair prediction before he even had a kick for United. I forget your question.
I said, what would be considered a good season? Is this season an all right season? Because I said 14 goals is pretty decent. I think it's probably, as you said, it's part for the course.
If he scored in every remaining game, or if he doesn't score again until the FA Cup final, it's a winner, then it's definitely a good season, because it's an FA Cup final winning goal. But it's too early to judge. We'll obviously judge come the end of May. But I mean, in terms of a possible name that springs to mind in terms of someone who I think would be an adequate, somewhat savvy recruit for keeping Hoyland on his toes, you look at someone like Niklas Füllkrug at Dortmund, who leads the line for them most weeks. I think his goal-scoring record is probably quite similar to Hoyland's. But he's playing in a team that a Champions League semi-finalists. And I'm just looking now, he's got 2 years left on his contract. Now, what I'd say to United is, if you can swap him with Jadon Sancho, that's a logical way of going about it.
Get you in the boardroom. That's what I say. On that subject, a nice little segue. What do you think is the view of Sir Jim Ratcliffe at the moment? He's been Co-owner for a couple of months now. Jason Wilcox has been installed as technical director. He's been present at a few games. He was at Leigh Sports Village for the Under-18s Cup final. And he was at the Burnley game on Saturday. What do you think they are thinking right now with the performances, where United are at, and Ten Hag's future?
Okay. I mean, I'd rather not go down the route of educated guesswork, but they can't be happy with it. How could they be happy with it? Look at where United are in the league table. Look at their form. Look at their performance in Europe this season. The meek manner in which they went out of the League Cup to quite a rather, was it heavily rotated Newcastle? Would you have said that that night, or reasonably rotated? Yeah, exactly.
Heavily rotated,
exactly.
Very, very fair.
Yeah. Exactly. And of course, they've got the FA Cup final, and there'll be a sense of occasion about that. And a manager getting into three finals in 2 years is not to be sniffed at. But it's that cliche, the bread and butter is the league form. That is the reliable gauge of where a club is at, how they're performing. You can fluke it in cup competitions. We saw it with Liverpool in 2005 in the Champions League, with Chelsea in 2012 in the Champions League. Portsmouth, when they won the FA Cup in 2008, was so, so lucky. They had huge luck in just about every game they played, but their name was written on the cup that year. United absolutely battered them in the quarterfinals and should have had a penalty early in the first half, and then Portsmouth got a penalty in the second half, and they managed to hang on. Goal line scramble that day as well, I remember, with Michael Carrick. Sometimes your luck is in with a cup run, but it's not a reliable gauge of where a team is at, no matter how much others may try and push it to the foreground and make it as prominent as possible. Ultimately, when you look at the Premier League table this season, United have lost 12 games out of 34. They've only won 16. Ten Hag has said quite a lot recently how they've been scoring quite a lot of goals this year. Again, he's talking about this calendar year. A season starts in August, and I know they had issues in August, but you can't just judge them on this calendar year. You've got to judge them on the whole season. And it goes back, as I said, to the poor planning of the summer, in that they signed an unproven striker for £72 million. They thought Anthony Martial was sufficient backup. Okay, Rashford has let them down this season. But you said it yourself, they've scored as many goals as Bournemouth. Looking at Newcastle below them, Newcastle have scored 22 more goals than United, which is staggering. I had no idea that they'd outscored United that much. And at the other end, they've conceded 51 goals, which is, they're in danger of ending the season with one of their worst defensive records in decades. There's a chance they could have a worse record than two seasons ago.
The goal difference has been in the minuses, or just plus one. It's only been plus one, I think, three times over.
Since Sheffield United.
Yeah, so I mean, they're on one now, but Manchester United should have a better goal difference than bloody one, shouldn't they? It's very disappointing. During Samuel's answer there, if you are watching on YouTube, not on podcast form, a dark shadow came across the MEN office and he briefly looked like a Bond villain. So take from that as you wish from the second
I think part. Some might think that's a suitable role that I'm playing at the moment. I'd take exception to that. But
and we'll be back in a moment for part three. United played six games in 3 days, Samuel, and they've now got a 9-day break until facing Crystal Palace at Selhurst Park. A rest day, a bit of time on the training ground to prepare for that match. Four games remaining now in the Premier League. They don't want Conference League. That would be incredibly embarrassing.
It would. I'm still dwelling on your Bond villain quote there. I suppose you could say, given my skill at transcribing, I've got gold fingers.
I knew you were going to come up with a song in the interlude.
Bloody hell. I know that was terrible.
I couldn't think of one myself, so I left you to it.
Well, we've bounced off each other quite well there, I suppose, haven't we? I think I forget again your question, or was it something like they've got a 9-day gap? What can they do?
Yeah, basically, obviously Crystal Palace on the horizon. I mean, the season's only got a few weeks left now. In terms of their finishing position in the Premier League and who they've got left to play, obviously Arsenal at home. Crystal Palace are in good form as well. That won't be an easy game at Selhurst Park. But when you look at the table, there's potential they could play Conference League next season, or Europa League, of course. If they win the FA Cup, that would be an easier route into that. But Conference League would be an embarrassment. No Manchester United fan wants to see the club in that competition, and you'd rather them just be out of Europe altogether, wouldn't you, than be in that.
I think a lot of fans would quite relish the novelty of playing in the Conference League, which is, it's the de facto what used to be the Cup Winners' Cup. I mean, it sounded so much better when it was the Cup Winners' Cup, and the Cup Winners' Cup trophy was a lot much better than the Conference League trophy, which is just a thinner version of the UEFA Cup, really? It's like a vase that you could put some flowers in. But I think a lot of United matchgoers would be keen to still be in Europe. And
well, I thought that, Samuel, because if you're in West Ham or Newcastle, you're excited for those kind of trips. But every fan that I've talked to about that have said, we don't want to be in Conference League. I'd rather just be out of Europe.
Yeah, I don't doubt that the majority would say, just get out of Europe. Let's focus on the league and climbing the league table. And there's absolute merit in that. But also selfishly, from a journalistic perspective, it's so much easier when you've got more games to cover. I now regret saying back in December when it came to the Champions League table, I just wanted United to finish second or finish fourth. I thought, don't drop into the Europa League. And I think all of us thought that. But when it comes around and you've got these spare midweeks, and the weeks are not broken up by a midweek match, and you've not got the press conference or a European game, and the coverage around those games is not particularly interesting, to be honest. The interest in pre-match press conferences for the Europa League is not particularly high. There's no real sense of occasion about them. There was last season when, of course, United played Barcelona, but I think it was irrelevant what the competition was. It felt at that time that was the biggest game in European football that week. It trumped the Champions League matches that week because it was, in my view, two of the three biggest clubs in the world coming up against each other, and they were two brilliant games as well. So selfishly, and let's face it, I think United will be in Europe next season because West Ham certainly don't have it in them to finish above them. Newcastle do, I think the lowest United could possibly finish is seventh. So that does ensure that they'll be in one of the two Europas next season. And you look at Chelsea this season, they've not maximised being out of Europe whatsoever. They've been a carbon copy of the Chelsea of last season, but there have been examples in recent memory of teams thriving without European football. Chelsea won the league in 16-17 when they were completely out of European competition under Conte. Liverpool had that remarkable and unlikely title challenge in 2013-14 when they had absolutely no European football to play. One of the most extraordinary title victories in English football history was, of course, Leicester in 2015-16. And, of course, they weren't in Europe. They barely stayed in the Premier League from the previous season. So there is absolute merit in not being in Europe, but I don't think United are going to get off that easy. They're going to be in one of the two Europas, and I don't think there's even a different anthem for the Europa Conference League. It's
do you know what I hear?
Sequential.
It's on TNT Sports now, not BT Sports, but there's this rock song and it promotes the Europa League.
Oh, yes.
Thursday nights. Europa nights. Oh,
I know.
My mate just sings it to wind me up because he knows how much I hate it. It gives us PTSD. I flinch every time it comes on the TV. It's terrible. United.
Well, I hope you'll enjoy your trip to Chisinau next year or next season, sorry, or one of the backwaters.
Well, it's a nice little segue as well, because look, United are on 54 points, Newcastle are on 53. So a point ahead, they've both played the same number of games, on 34. Goal difference could be important, as we've just referenced there. United have got Palace, Arsenal, Newcastle and Brighton. They've got Arsenal and Newcastle both at home at Old Trafford. Now, you look at those fixtures, from a Newcastle perspective, that is their cup final for the rest of the season. United are in an actual cup final, of course, are in the FA Cup final, but Eddie Howe's team, that is their game that really matters now, from now until the end of the season. When you look at the table, that'll be massive in deciding Europe. But when you look at how Newcastle performed away from home, Samuel, they've only won 4 games this year, which gives United hope of prevailing.
This season or this year, sorry, Stephen.
This season, sorry, I should clarify. Yeah. They've been really poor away from home this season. So that gives hope. That gives United hope of actually emerging from that result for a positive result.
I did think that, certainly looking at Newcastle fixtures, I think, I mean, Burnley, as I said, have not lost many games recently, and they absolutely need to win on, is that Saturday, I take it? They're going to Turf Moor, Newcastle, I think. So I wouldn't be surprised if Newcastle drop points there. I think Brighton at home, you look at the state Brighton are in at the moment, and I mean, it'd be a brave big club to give Roberto De Zerbi the job based on one exceptional season with Brighton. I mean, he's been almost a mirror image of Ten Hag, one very good season, one very, very bad season. Going off Brighton standards, I don't think any of us thought that Brighton would possibly end in the bottom half of the table, but that's where they are at the moment. And of course, you know, the United game, there will be something riding on that, I think, in that penultimate midweek fixture. And I mean, you said it yourself this season, that sometimes it brings the best out of United if it's an evening game. And that, of course, will be an evening game, but that might also bring the best out of Newcastle. They'll have a good following, as they always do at Old Trafford, and they'll be up for it. And I suspect there'll be something riding on that game in terms of, you know, Newcastle could be ahead of United, or United are ahead of Newcastle, but whoever wins, that could decide who finishes sixth and who finishes seventh. Because watching Arsenal yesterday, I think, as Klopp said that if United play the way they did against Liverpool, then Arsenal will beat them. And Arsenal were really, really impressive at Tottenham yesterday. I thought what they showed particularly impressive mettle in the second half, when after those two bad errors by Raya and Rice, they didn't look like conceding. It was almost as if there were just two really poor moments in that second half. It wasn't bad game management, it was just bad mistakes by two individuals. And after that, they regrouped immediately. And you look at Arsenal and the players in that team and how well drilled they are, their body language, the way they conduct themselves, they are a proper team. And they have been for quite some time now under Arteta. And I know I'm not saying anything revelatory there, but Arsenal have not won at Old Trafford in the league with supporters present since 2006. And there's a very, very good chance that run will end in May, because they're a really top side. I think that the fact that people were not so much surprised, but certainly there'd have been disappointment at Arsenal that they didn't get past Bayern Munich in the Champions League, that gives you an idea of where they're at. And they've improved on last season as well, Arsenal. They were slightly unfortunate to lose at Old Trafford at the start of last season, when they got done on a couple of breakaways by United. But if you're looking at those three Ten Hag Arteta games, Arsenal have probably been the more impressive side in all three of them.
They've got a kind of grit and steeliness and determination about them this season, don't they? That I don't think they had last year, which is probably just experience and know-how and maybe a little bit of scar tissue that helps that.
And Rice coming in as well, definitely.
Fantastic signing. Should we end the podcast then by giving a quick mention to another rival manager, Samuel, Jurgen Klopp, because I think he is cracking up at the moment.
Well, Ten Hag's eras can come to an end, and he certainly contributed to Klopp's era ending on a sour note. You just look at the the form column for Liverpool since Ahmad dumped them out of the FA Cup.
Like a packet of fruit pastels, isn't it, without the green ones in?
I don't even know where to begin there. That analogy, I'm struggling to make head or tail of it. I'm going to have to process that for a while. But it's, you know, the fact that United's games recently have been soundtracked to Jürgen's cracking up. It shows that one, their United season, league season is a write-off, and the fans, all they care about is the FA Cup, and rightly so. But also, the light's back on me now. I've got a halo over my head. I'm not a Spectre agent anymore. But it's, yeah, as I said, it's actually quite funny how Liverpool, you probably heard the chant at Goodison last week after Everton won 2-0, you lost the league at Goodison Park. And like 5 years ago when they dropped points at Everton and United and it cost them the title, it's happened again. So, fair play to Ten Hag. His era might be about to end, but he's ensuring that Klopp's is ending on a bum note.
I think they're filming a documentary, aren't they, for Klopp's farewell season. I wonder if on the final scene it'll just end with Ahmad's goal hitting the back of the net and cutscene, that'll be it, and they'll just end the documentary then. Nothing else happened after that.
It probably accounts for why he's always, it's almost as if he's got an earpiece in and someone's saying, "You're on camera now," and he just he's grinning like that full beam smile. Just why? Why? Jared Branthwaite scores. Yeah, it's a full beam smile. There are no two ways about it.
Could have made a Jaws reference there from Bond, but we'll end there. We missed that opportunity. Thanks for your time, Samuel.
Thank you, Stephen.
And thanks to the listeners. I hope I've been in all right form considering my life-threatening illness, which is COVID.
Fine form. Fine, yeah, Fettle, definitely.
Have a great week and we'll be back on Friday. Thank you. Take care.